You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Well, the news is so gosh darn heavy almost every day. I thought we'd start out this afternoon on a wee bit of a light note. Had to go back into the vault for this one. See if you can identify who's speaking on this clip. One of the voices, you will for sure know who this is. But the other two might remain a little elusive. But please, enjoy this blast from the past as much as I did. I hope you all do. Take a listen here.
Who are your favorite authors?
Well, I have a number of favorite authors. I think Tom Wolfe is excellent.
Did you read Vanity of the Bonfires?
I did not.
It's a phenomenal book.
What book are you reading now?
Well, I'm Bonfire of the Vanities.
I'm reading my own book again because I think it's so fantastic, Tom.
What's the best book you've read beside Art of the Deal?
I really like Tom Wolfe's last book, and I think he's a great author. He's done a beautiful job.
Which book?
His current book. His current book. It's just out.
Bonfire of the Vanities.
Yes. The man has done a very, very good job, and I really can't hear with his earphone, by the way.
You can't. Does this remind anybody else of Sarah Palin? Which newspapers do you read? All of them. I read all of the papers, and I can see Russia from my porch. That's Pat Buchanan talking with Donald Trump on a circa 1990s-ish talk show, asking him, who's your favorite author? What books are you reading? I like Tom Wolfe. Which Tom Wolfe book? Can't name one. Oh, that recent one, Bonfire of the Vanities. I'm not reading that one, but I like his most recent. You can't make this stuff up. It's so Sarah Palin-esque. I just had to share it with you. We need some yucks every now and again here on the show. Folks, thanks for joining me. It is hump day afternoon here on the Civic Media Radio Network. My name's Maggie Dawn, and this is The Maggie Dawn Show. We've got a great show planned for you today. I am extremely excited. At the top of the 5 o'clock hour, I'm going to be talking with a person whose family has their very own story about getting health care through the Affordable Care Act exchanges. We're going to dig in to what that experience has been like and what they're concerned about as the enrollment season is quickly upon us and Republicans continue to refuse to negotiate with Democrats over how to end the shutdown. It's pretty rich. Oh, just in case anybody was keeping track, I think my favorite Tom Wolfe book, I had to think about it. I've read a bunch of them. Interestingly, I never read Bonfire of the Vanities. Watch the movie. But I really loved I Am Charlotte Simmons. That one's still on my shelf. I also thought Back to Blood was really fascinating. If you're looking for some Tom Wolfe reading material this weekend. In other breaking news, as we like to start the show this afternoon, the Trump administration suffered a big, big loss. It may be only temporary, but I think not. Big, big loss yesterday before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. This was late breaking news. The Ninth Circuit, of course, is on the West Coast. It covers 10-ish states, including California and Oregon as relevant here. You will recall that just a couple of weeks ago, a 3-judge panel from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that despite the fact that there's absolutely no factually based argument that a rebellion to overthrow the United States government is happening in Portland. Yes, they are protesting. Yes, they do not like Customs and Border Protection thugs rounding up people who have lived here for 20 plus years with thuggish type tactics very violently. Yes, there is some of these protesters, a tiny, tiny proportion of them, are criminals that are destroying property or generally breaking the law, and those people should always be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. But there's no government rebellion. Despite that reality, just a couple weeks ago, this 3-judge panel from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, we'll just will just ignore what's actually happening and take the government, take Donald Trump's word for it. That panel, of course, had, big surprise here, two Trump-appointed judges on it and a third. Well, as I predicted then, the day that decision dropped, that case is being reheard en banc by the entirety or a big, huge proportion of the Ninth Circuit. That's what that en banc means. It's a Latin term meaning basically the whole of the court. And the interesting bit to note here was that in agreeing to take this case up en banc, the Ninth Circuit also vacated the earlier order from that three-judge panel. That means that that decision, you know, agreeing with the completely made-up fiction that there's some sort of armed rebellion that actually seeks to overthrow the government, that earlier decision is no longer valid. It's effectively nullified. And this means that the restraining order preventing the deployment of National Guard troops to Portland remains in effect. This is incredibly important. 15, at least 15, we don't know the exact vote, but at least 15 of the 29 total active judges on the Ninth Circuit would have voted for this en banc rehearing. It's a big deal. And that original ruling that I was talking about, that three-judge panel ruling, that came down on October 20th. So what are we going to see now? Well, first of all, this is going to take a while. These en banc hearings take a while to logistically put together. There's full argument again. So it's probably going to take a month or so. So that restraining order is going to stay in place. No National Guard in Portland. And what's really important here, in addition to the logistics of the timing, is the fact that the Ninth Circuit, which is by far the busiest federal appeals court region in the United States, it only agrees to take about 1, 2, 3 cases per year for en banc rehearing. In other words, it's extremely rare, and they hear thousands and thousands and thousands of cases in a given year. So when en banc rehearings are granted, it is typically the case that you can expect a reversal of whatever that initial appeals court smaller three-judge panel ruling was. So very, very interesting. A little wonk here, because, you know, I'm your lady lawyer on the radio, but a little wonk here and some good news to go with our bit of fun and jest to begin this afternoon. And, wow, more good news to share with all of you. A federal judge in Seattle has now ruled that the Trump administration cannot cancel $1 billion in school-based mental health grants, including that $10 million of a $12 million federal grant that was headed here to Wisconsin. Remember, I talked about this with all of you fine folks just a couple of 2, 3 weeks ago. So again, a federal judge saying, no, when Congress appropriates pursuant to legislation, the administration doesn't get just cancel all of the, no, who cares about that first branch of government? We'll ignore that. The grants here in Wisconsin were intended to hire 14,000 mental health professionals in high-need schools. Again, very abruptly cut. And the judge found that this cancellation was likely to be found ultimately when the case is heard fully on its merits. Again, this is also in a temporary restraining order posture. The judge concluded that this cancellation was arbitrary, capricious, and causing irreparable harm to states and students. So this is a very big deal. This is a big win for every single family in the state of Wisconsin whose children have some sort of special needs. And that crosses every party line, socioeconomic line. This matters to every single Wisconsinite writ large, because absent this federal funding, that money has to be made up somewhere. And we know that our taxpayer dollars, when it comes to public education, are absolutely stretched to their maximum. Hence why we've seen an historic number of referendums in these past election cycles to fund our public schools through property tax increases. Of course, the GOP in Wisconsin has introduced legislation to no longer allow local communities to decide if they want to fund their public schools through those kinds of referendums. I wonder what that's about. You know, this party that pounds the table about local control all the time, why would you ever want to take away a city or a county's ability to have their voters decide if they want to raise their taxes to better fund their own public schools? Why might you want to do that? I wonder, might it have something to do with a decades-long plan to basically completely undermine public education as it's been known, to completely then take those taxpayer dollars that have funded equally accessible Title IX guaranteed fair public education for all, regardless of income level, and put it into religiously based voucher and charter programs that can discriminate willy-nilly and deny admission to children based on basically anything that they want? Maybe that's what it's about. Oh, yeah, that would seem to be the case since the Trump administration is dismantling the Department of Education. That might be a reason why Republicans in the state of Wisconsin would want to do away with the local control that they seem to love so very much in so many other circumstances. Also, another little tidbit of news from here in Wisconsin. Sean Duffy, transportation secretary extraordinaire, in an online fight with Elon Musk, who's now calling him Sean Dummy. That's always interesting to watch. Sean Duffy's son-in-law has announced a bid for Wisconsin's 7th congressional district. Michael Alfonso, 20, is 25 years old. And I've been, you know, searching to find out what Mr. Alfonso's deep credentials would be to run for Congress. And I'm coming up with, he's 25, Sean Duffy's son-in-law, and he's branding himself as a hardcore pro-Trump conservative. I think that's what he thinks are his qualifications. I don't know about you all. I was still in graduate school when I was 25, but it would not have occurred to me, ladies and gentlemen, to be like, you know what I should do? I have so much, such a wealth of experience. I've had so much hardship in my life that I'm sure I should be a congressperson. 25, son-in-law of Sean Duffy, hardcore pro-Trump conservative. Yeah, that a congressman makes. We're going to come back on the other side. We're going to get into shutdown day 29. Would you believe that Mike Johnson continues to say stupid things about it? We discuss next. Don't go anywhere. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Remember, I come to you from WAUK, right here in southeastern Wisconsin, and we got a brand new big old FM stick that you can hear us loud and clear almost anywhere you are here in southeastern Wisconsin. That station is 100.3 FM. Please tell all your friends about it and get them to tune in and participate. 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. It is day 29 of the shutdown. Jack Hole Johnson continues to have his head buried in the sand, acting like, oh, there's nothing to see here, nothing for Congress to do, as they tick into like the 80th day of their vacation out of the last 90. Hasn't brought the House back into session, won't swear in the newly elected congresswoman from Arizona, despite an ever-changing, mysterious list of very suspicious reasons why he won't do that. When everybody knows, there's just one reason why he won't do that. Epstein. But of course, as we always do, and as I like to do, let's remind ourselves who is ultimately responsible for this shutdown.
when the government is, you know, they talk about the government shutdown, they're going to be talking about the president of the United States. Who was the president at that time? Mm-hmm. They're not going to be talking who the head of the House was, the head of the Senate, who's running things in Washington. So I really think the pressure is on the president.
If there is a shutdown, I think it would be a tremendously negative mark on the president of the United States. He's the one that has to get people together.
Which is difficult when you're in Asia, which is doubly difficult when the House is out of session. Yeah. And here is, of course, Mike Johnson saying other stupid things yesterday. Take a listen to this.
And that's why the polling continues to show that the approval of Republicans in Congress is rising with each passing day, and the Democrats at the same time, Democrats in Congress have the lowest approval rating they have ever had since polling began, since recorded polling began on these metrics.
Mike, nothing like a good cherry pick. Here is the actual most recent polling on the shutdown. By a 14% margin, Americans blame Donald Trump and the Republicans for the shutdown. That is up 4% from last week, with independents overwhelmingly blaming Trump and the Republicans because it's their fault. They may have passed a continuing resolution, but they have no actual resolution to the healthcare Armageddon that is awaiting millions of Americans. A healthcare Armageddon that they themselves created when they passed the big, brutal bill to crush the middle class and benefit the billionaire bro club, most of whom are now cutting checks to Donald Trump for his ballroom. Isn't that weird how that works out? Tax breaks for you. Billionaires give me tens of millions of dollars for my big old vanity project. Weird. And here's the other actual polling statistic. 64% of Americans say Trump and Republicans should compromise on the Affordable Care Act subsidies. That's up 9% from last week. Mike Johnson's out of touchedness. I mean, we can refer back to the fact that he apparently had some like porn tracker on his kid's computer and phone, and then they would It was very strange. Yeah. Mike Johnson. And his whining about all of this never seems to cease. This is here, again, he is the Speaker of the House, a title afforded to the majority party in the House. Here's him complaining about the fact that Republicans aren't actually in charge, despite holding both houses of Congress, the presidency, and the Supreme Court by margins. Listen to this.
The Democrats are required to open the government. They keep saying Republicans are in charge of government. We aren't, not in the Senate.
Yeah, they could go the nuclear option, get rid of the 60-vote threshold, and pass the sucker. Democrats are required to pass the budget or a continuing resolution. Then wouldn't that indicate that you probably should be negotiating with them about their single demand? And here's the thing, this whole like feigned concern about SNAP that's coming from Republicans, what a load of hooey. I didn't know you cared so much. Let's review their record on SNAP and emergency food assistance. The big brutal bill changed SNAP eligibility to boot children off of SNAP. The very thing that gets them free school meals. Yep, they want those kids booted off of SNAP. They've repeatedly attempted to raise the eligibility threshold for the community eligibility provision under SNAP, which allows high poverty schools to automatically offer free meals to all students. You know, when like 90% of the people that send their kids, the families that send their kids to your school are at or below the federal poverty level, you just give everybody something to eat because to learn, you probably need some food in your belly. Yeah, they want that gone. According to a Food and Research and Action Center analysis, this is going to cause 24,000 schools to lose eligibility and impact more than 12 million students. And on a state-by-state basis, 15 Republican states opted out of the federal summer EBT program known as Sunbucks, which provided low-income families with $120 to purchase groceries for each eligible school-age child over the summer. So no to those school lunches, no to feeding kids in the summer, and apparently now no to feeding America writ large. Charming, aren't they? When we come back, I am going to be joined by State Senator Sarah Kieski of Senate District 14. We're going to talk about Wisconsin Democrats' plan to bring to Wisconsinites an affordable Wisconsin. Nothing can be more important in these times when the MAGA Party has abandoned the middle class. Stay tuned. I'm Maggie Dawn, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome, everybody. Welcome back if you're rejoining me. My name's Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It's Wednesday. It is 4:30, and that means it's time for a little segment we like to call here Broad Appeal. And by that, I mean in this segment every Wednesday, I love to have these great conversations with women elected leaders, candidates, activists, organizers, and folks that genuinely care about their community and helping us all do better together. We've got one great such guest with us this afternoon. She is State Senator Sarah Kieski of the Fighting Senate District 14. It's great to have you with us, Sarah. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's a delight. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So for folks who are not familiar with your district, what regions of the country, of the state does it cover? And how long have you been a senator? How did you come into this politics game, especially in these trying times?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so I'll try to make it brief. I'm actually, by trade, a mental health provider and have done that for 27 years now. I still do that, individual, family, and couples therapy. And I got asked to run. And so sort of the circuitous route brought me to the state Senate. I am, as you said, state senator for District 14, and that is all of Richland County, all of Sauk County, most of Columbia County, and then a small portion of Dane County, Adams County, and Juneau County.
Yeah, it's quite a diverse area of the state, which I think presents a lot of unique opportunities to speak to the sets of issues that really cross the urban-rural divide that are about working Wisconsinites no matter what corner of the state folks are from. So let's talk about that exact initiative. Wisconsin Democrats have dubbed a program and campaign, an initiative, if you will, Affordable Wisconsin. It's a pretty catch-all term. So tell us what this is about and how Democrats are communicating this to their constituents, regardless of party preference.
Well, I think, you know, unfortunately, there is a misnomer that sometimes Democrats are out of touch or maybe part of the elite. And one of the things that has been really eye-opening for me and something that's been really pushing me very much of a propellant is to try to help people understand that those of us that are in service that are have a D by our name are very interested in and care about working class people. That's what I am. That's what I've always been. I grew up on a small farm. My mom was a nurse. My dad was a farmer and also worked for the railroad. So that's my lineage. And so I understand just normal, everyday people's real concerns, paying for groceries, paying for either rent or a house payment, being able to afford medical care, and sometimes deciding because of the prices that you stay home rather than go in, or you don't call the ambulance if it's needed because of the prices being so high. And so it's really trying to bring that message that we hear those concerns, we live those concerns, and we want to do things that can help our constituents across the board, rural, suburban, and urban, that address these issues. There's healthcare, there's childcare. I mean, we all are struggling with our pocketbook. And so it's really trying to bring that that on the road, talking to real people about these issues, and then coming back to the Capitol with then new ideas maybe of what we can do to make things more affordable.
You know, there's this challenge that exists in moments of hyper-partisanship, certainly right now. And that is both communicating what I think is an absolutely factual, indisputable record of the success of the most core Democratic policies over the last 50 years, while acknowledging at the same time that that success has left many folks behind, and that I think it is a fair criticism of the Democratic Party to say, as the role of money in politics has accelerated, the Democratic Party has to fight that pull of corporate interests, as any party who should be serving the middle class would do. And so it's difficult to both say, hey, our record stands up to any question, and it wasn't enough, it isn't enough, and we've got to do better. How are you managing to balance trying to do both of those things and listen to what people are saying about their areas of dissatisfaction?
You know, the biggest thing for me is to be as real and honest and authentic about what I really believe, what I live every day. I'm not somebody that's had a history in politics. So for me, much of this is very surreal. And yes, some of it's very disheartening. And I talk about that. I talk about learning about money and politics to the degree that it is, and how, and I use the word gross regularly because it feels really gross. And that is across the board, right? Is that once Citizens United in particular, although there's all kinds of things that have contributed, it's become much more of corporate interests being able to put their thumb on the scale. And that's just the reality, and trying to then fight against that by really helping people understand that we all have a vote, but we have to use those votes, because otherwise the money will decide for us what we get if we as a people don't decide what we get by voting. And that's, you know, it's a simple message, but it's also really important to make sure that we're all actively involved. And I don't know that people care enough about politics right now, or feel like there's enough good going on in politics to really be involved, or to care about somebody that's trying to work for them. They maybe think that they're not sincere, or they're, you know, underhanded, or don't trust them, you know. So it's very tricky. And so it's, for me, it's been really about like just building relationships and letting people know, like, I'm really just a really regular person, a mom that's trying to pay my bills and get, you know, braces on my kids' teeth if I can afford it. But you know what? I had twins, so I had to go one at a time. I mean, like things like that. Because
did you flip a coin? How did you figure that one out?
Very good question. I think it was the one that was born first got them. It just was that.
And the one born minutes later will forever be resentful. I joke, of course. But
I think I'm actually resentful of the one that was born second, because she was born breech, and so she always gets a little bit like, no. I tease her.
Folks, if you're just joining us, I've got Senator Sarah Kieski of the 14th Senate District. We're talking about the Democrats' new campaign called Affordable Wisconsin, trying to both, I think, bring some clarity to what the record of Democrats have been in terms of working for working people, as well as be very candid about the work that needs to be done where we've fallen short. Here's a question for you. Speaking of money and politics, I recently had on a guest from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. He talked about what is termed the Montana Plan. In brief, what it means is to change each state's law of corporations, its business law that is in the statutes, to forbid corporations or foreign corporations, meaning corporations that are based in other states, from spending money in any election in the state of Wisconsin, which I thought was a genius idea. Is this being talked about amongst any of your colleagues, Republican or Democratic, within the state Senate or beyond?
You know, there haven't been real conversations yet, but we haven't also met as a caucus for a bit because we're not getting to do any work. Yeah, we're not in. I mean, we could be, we should be, but we're not. And so, but I did read about that and I thought that was just such an intriguing idea. I love the idea of starting to figure out how are we going to address this at a state level then? Because obviously at a federal level, it's just been a disaster that we've had to live under.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that whether you talk to Republicans or Democrats or people that are disgusted with politics and don't want to have anything to do with it, if you talk about, hey, would you support changing laws to get money out of politics in our state, the whole room will stand up and go, hell yeah. Because we all know intuitively, whether it's an elected official or you know, an administration writ large, people tend to do what is in their individualized best interest to an extent, right? And when that is, I want to win re-election, and there is a flow of money that is necessary to win re-elections in this country, you know, trying to figure out how to stem that tide would be incredibly powerful. And I think re-engaging for so many people, right? So let's put a pin in that because I want to begin to talk about some of these campus closures, especially the UW Baraboo campus closure. Have you been tracking this? What do you see in the future? What are you thinking about might be doable as a state legislature to address some of this? Because it appears that not only are things getting geographically less accessible, but the starving of funding for the entirety of the UW system is forcing tuition increases when in the past, the University of Wisconsin system was a point of pride for every Wisconsinite because it made higher education accessible and affordable for basically any family that wanted to send their kid to a university or even a two-year program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tragedy. I mean, that's what it is. We were a beacon as a state with education, and we're losing that high level of excellence and that sort of a being a Mecca where people want to come, not just for the 4-year, obviously, but really recognizing these 2-year campuses have been a gateway for so many people to maybe stay in their communities and start their journey in education in a way that is affordable, accessible, and to see these closures keep happening. One happened in Richland Center, 2023, which is in my district. Now BU in Baraboo. Honestly, it's heartbreaking and seeing that there's not been an appreciation of not only the importance of this for students, but really recognizing that these are economic drivers in these small rural communities that is having a huge impact. And I think that we need to be investing in our small communities. And I think there's the other party talks about, you know, believing in rural Wisconsin and believing in, opportunities for people so that they can, you know, be uplifted. But I'm not seeing that in some of the pragmatic ways. And this to me is one of those pragmatic ways where you keep access to education, you keep access to training, you keep access to affordability for our young people so that, and then we can keep, like I said, the economic generator there, we can help, we can make sure that these kids can maybe stay in our state because they're staying connected in their rural roots. And it's just not happening. And I just think it's a travesty.
Folks, that's State Senator Sarah Kieski of Senate District 14, my guest in this week's edition of Broad Appeal. We're going to continue our conversation on the other side, tackling a bipartisan bill introduced by Senator Kieski alongside Senator Jesse James, who has been a guest on this program, about how to help people reintegrate through substance abuse and mental health treatment as they exit incarceration circumstances. If you truly care about crime, this is something that you understand needs to be done to help people help contribute to their communities. Stay tuned as we dig into that next, right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on this hump day afternoon. We are in the 4:30 half hour. We are in the midst of our broad appeal segment, which we do every week at this time. I've got State Senator Sarah Kieski of State Senate District 14 with me. She's been on the show before, if you've heard her voice. It is so lovely to have her back. I especially, Sarah, wanted to talk about this bill that you've introduced alongside Senator Jesse James, a Republican who has been on this program before. This is a bill that is addressed, is specifically designed to reduce healthcare costs for folks with substance use disorder who are already eligible for Medicaid and are currently incarcerated either in our state prison system or in county jails as they're getting ready for release. Tell us how this works. First of all, just the nuts and bolts of the bill. What is it you're asking for?
So right now, state or local municipalities pay for any kind of medical behavioral health type treatment if somebody is incarcerated. And that can be a cost that is hard to manage, especially in small localities. And so this is not just considering that cost piece, but also what happens is once somebody that has been incarcerated is then released, then their care ends right there. And so then they all of a sudden have to kind of figure out, well, where am I going to maybe get my medication assisted treatment if I have a substance abuse or disorder, or where am I going to do case management? Where am I going to get the services needed? So what this is having getting a Medicaid waiver through the federal government, which allows then incarcerated individuals to start getting those services up to 90 days before release so that they can begin the process of getting those things into place. So when they are then released, they will have up to 30 days of medication that they might need, or again, some of these services already kind of established. This can help with any recidivism, because what we know is that if people are struggling, they're going to be more likely to maybe go back to their use of substances and or struggling in other ways. And so, and there's also a high incident of overdose deaths following incarceration. And so we're really trying to think about the person, but also then the context of the community and how this can help healthier communities, improve these outcomes, and also help the finances of our state.
Yeah, it serves a number of purposes, right? It's good for taxpayers, and it's good for community, and it's good for the person who is incarcerated. This is one of those things that I do not understand why there isn't just an absolute stampede of bipartisan legislators to support something like this. Yeah. We all know that a lot of folks that commit crimes, especially what I'm going to call some of the lower end offenses, less violent offenses, are people that are struggling with either undiagnosed or undertreated mental health disorders. Mm-hmm. And therefore, or not related to that, end up with substance abuse disorders. If we're not going to simply lock up everyone who has a serious mental health problem for the rest of their lives, or lock up someone and just incarcerate and criminalize all addiction permanently, which is not something society can bear the cost of, right, nor is it a moral thing to do. Right. It's inhumane. Mm-hmm. Then the idea of trying to help people as they're transitioning out of a facility and back into their communities with mental health issues and with substance abuse issues is the most no-brainer thing I could buy. Like, it is up there in the why the hell haven't we done this yet category. And again, if you are actually concerned about crime and making communities safer, this is where you make an investment, right? My guess is that in states that have this, I didn't have time to research this, but that have this, they see pretty good returns on the dollars here. And again, This is trying to bring federal dollars in so that there's less burden on state and local taxpayers. I'll just make this last observation, and then I'd like to get your sense in our last couple of minutes here of whether or not you think this will be successful. Whether you're talking rural or suburban or urban county jail facilities, guess what, folks? Being incarcerated is one of the only circumstances in this country where you are guaranteed health care. Mm-hmm. And it is hella expensive. That is borne by state and local taxpayers. And anything that helps reduce crime and reduce those costs is great for everybody. That is my last word on that. It is a challenge in Milwaukee County. Is it a challenge in Ashland County and Brown County and everywhere? Because that is one of the most at-risk populations, that whether you're talking about mental health or substance abuse disorders. What do you think the odds are that this gets enacted into law, Senator Kieske?
Well, so again, we have to get a waiver from the federal government. So this is a bill that would ask our Department of Human Services to do that ask. So it's trying to get that piece passed, right? So I'm hopeful, but I'm not sure that the other side of the aisle is going to be as supportive as I would hope, because sometimes there's a desire to keep punishing people that have done wrong. And it's hard sometimes to see this need to also have this humane effort to help them achieve better so that we can all benefit. And so that's one of the pieces. Then whether or not the federal government will allow it is going to be the next question. And we're a purple state. We'll see.
Folks, get on the horn, call your state senators and representatives and tell them to get behind this bill. It works for the person that is incarcerated. It works for the community. It works for taxpayer dollars. This is a no-brainer. When we come back, we talk with Rachel Lacasse Ford about her family's journey and the Affordable Care Act. Stay tuned. I'm Maggie Dawn, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.